I'm being quiet.
It's Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and therefore, from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen welcoming you to this week's episode of the John Mack Radio Show. And a film. Okay. And this is the 115th and 78th episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. It's the 115th and 78th episode because last week, about 5 minutes into the show, due to either an act of God or more likely failure on Con Ed's part, there was a pop and a very short power failure. When power was restored, everything came back up with the exception of the broadcast studio equipment. So reluctantly, the show had to be canceled. The first time in 115 Sundays, such an occurrence. But we have backup tonight with enhanced backup procedures and with the same guest. Their enhanced backup procedures was evident because the equipment just went down again. Now, I do have a brand new, very large picture Macintosh coming in next week to replace the equipment. So hopefully we won't have these problems again. URLs for the previous 114th show may be found at www.johnmack13.com under the radio show tab. And John Mack is johnmack13@gmail.com. My most recent piece for Westchester Guardian is a website, www.westchesterguardian.com. It includes 188th column in the Creative Disruption series. I hope you'll read the columns. And if desired, come back to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. At the link I mentioned before, www.johnmack13.com, you'll also find all of the previous radio shows and the link to my online daily newspaper. And try it and subscribe. There's only one email per day. And now to this show, the 115th in the series, or the 115th and 7th, 8th, as I mentioned. Callers may call in at any time during the show by dialing 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. But I do hold the on-air participation of callers to the conclusion of my interview with my guest. My guest tonight is Bagpiper, retired Yonkers police officer, and Narrowback's mainstay, John Ricciari. When I first met John at the Narrowback's luncheon, more than Narrowback's later, and then found out that he hung around in the same Mohegan Lakes Barnes & Noble as me and his previous guests on this show, Jim Casey, Don Wertzman, Renee Estabrook, and Rob McConte. But I also learned very soon that he is referred to as Rince rather than John. So here we go again. Welcome to the show, Rince.
Hello, John. Thanks for having me.
Where were you born and where did you grow up?
I was born in, I'm very proud to be a Bronx lifelong resident. Up until I moved out at a later age, I grew up in the Our Lady of Mercy Parish of that's on Marion Avenue, right off of Fordham Road. I lived on Decatur Avenue and 193rd Street.
Then where'd you go to early school?
I went to Our Lady of Mercy for kindergarten to the 8th grade, and from there I was off to Mount St. Michael for 1 year, and then I finished up in DeWitt Clinton.
You had a funny story at the Mount. I don't know if you want to get into it about someone playing the pranks on you that fouled up your final day?
Oh, yeah, that's a kind of a funny story. I'll get into that. I wasn't the best student at Mount St. Michael, and I didn't really pay attention that well to my studies, and I had a strong suspicion that came the last day of my freshman year that Mount St. Michael would be parting their ways with me, and I was going to get the boot, so to speak. So the night before the last day of school, we got our report cards. There was a sophomore that was a friend of mine that also went to the Mount, and he said to me, hey, listen, you know, last day of school, you can wear shorts. You don't have to wear your suit and tie. And I was like, really? Oh, that'd be great. You know, I don't have to get suit and tie on. I'll, you know, just be a lot more comfortable. It was hot. And I go to leave the house that morning, and my mother said, where do you think you're going? You know, put your suit and tie on. I said, no. I talked to Bruce last night. Bruce told me that nobody wears a suit and tie on the last day. Put your suit and tie. No. And I get an argument with my mom, which I end up leaving, and I run down to Webster Avenue to take one of three buses to get to Mount St. Michael. And I'm the only Mount St. Michael student standing there in shorts and a T-shirt. And a light should have went off in my head that maybe this is not going to work. But I proceeded all the way to Mount St. Michael. And I get online to get my report card, which was given out by class. I was in freshman class 1M. And my whole class is waiting to see if I was going to be a Mount St. Michael student come sophomore year. And the gentleman that was handing out the report cards has kind of a smirk on his face. He looks at my report card and he looks at me and says, when you come back here dressed like a Mount St. Michael student, you get your report card. And I said, oh, God, what am I going to do now? We have to take three buses home, another three buses back. So there was a kid in my class. His name was Gregory Rakowski. And, I'm about 5'8". Greg was probably at that time maybe 6'3" or so. And Greg says, oh, listen, I live about three blocks from school. Come to my house. I'll loan you a suit. So I says, oh, that's great. So I walked to Greg's house, 5-minute walk to his house. He ends up giving me a suit that the sleeves were kind of 3 inches down over my hand. I had these big, long pants on. He was a lot bigger than me. We had to tie a tie around my waist to keep the pants up. And I looked utterly ridiculous. And anyway, I come back to the Mount, and my friends are still waiting for me to get my report card. And gentleman, I guess I didn't know him. He must have been a late teacher, and he got a big chuckle out of it. It's all right, you know, I guess I'll give you the card. And there was my report card with a big red rubber stamp that told me my services were no longer required as a Mount St. Michael student. And I guess it was a good lesson learned, but it might not have been so funny at the time, but I think it's hysterical now.
They could have told you that in the beginning, by the way, you're out, but they didn't. On the brighter note, you got into Irish music rather early, as I believe. How did the person with an Italian surname jump into Irish music?
Well, it's kind of a funny story. Growing up in the neighborhood, it kind of started. It goes back. My parents, my dad, I guess, got his draft notice during World War II, and him and my mom were just getting married. They were newlyweds, and she insisted on moving into a building that had an elevator for some reason. She was obsessed with living in it. So the only building that they found an apartment in was in the Irish neighborhood where I grew up, on 193rd Street in Decatur. And the building was predominantly Irish. The neighborhood was, and many of the people in the neighborhood spoke with brogues. And so my friends growing up from when, I guess, right after I was born, most all my friends were Irish-American, and a good amount of their parents were Irish off the boat. And in lots of their houses, you would hear Irish music. And I would say before I even went to school, I just was wild over the music. And I would come home, and one particular family that lived around the corner from me was the Blue family. And Mrs. Blue always had Irish music playing in the house. And mind you, a lot of my friends didn't really care for it at that time as much. As I got older, they did. But at that time, we were kids. They were like, ah, this is diddly-dee music. And I would say before I even realized that maybe that I was Italian, that this was not the music I was probably slated to listen to. But I liked it, and I would come home, and I'd be singing Irish songs with a brogue. And my grandfather had immigrated from Italy. He was a classical musician, and he was a music professor. And my mom's name was Evelyn, and he would look at her. I'd come home singing these Irish songs, and they say, Evelyn, it's the time that you move out of this neighborhood. And so as time went on, I got more and more involved in the music, and I had a fascination with the bagpipe. And
now, did you play the instrument before the bagpipe, or was the bagpipe your first instrument?
Before the bagpipe, no. My first instrument actually were drums and the tin whistle. And I can remember I guess I was 11 years old when John F. Kennedy was assassinated, and being home watching the funeral, and twice there were bagpipes during the funeral. There was one when John F. Kennedy was taken out of the church after the mass and put back on to the caisson. There was a Scottish regiment, the Black Watch, had been here on tour, and they played. And then as they got to Arlington Cemetery, there was another pipe band, which was the U.S. Air Force at that time, had a very good pipe band. And they were playing as they came into Arlington. And I think that really started to spark my interest. I was just totally fascinated with the instrument. So
now,
did
you get to take lessons when you were young?
I eventually did, because in the beginning I really couldn't find anybody around that that played. And on Sunday afternoons, my family would have the big Italian meal, and I would always have Keol na Gael, the Irish radio show on from Fordham University, as we were eating the Italian meal. And one Sunday afternoon, there was the Kerry Pipe Band had an ad on the radio show that they were recruiting drummers. So I got the phone number, and I called the number. And coincidentally, the person that was the drum sergeant, which I didn't realize, was another OLM student, Sean Walsh. And I told him who I was, and I said, hey, could an Italian guy join your band as a drummer? Which I figured it would be a good way to get in and learn the pipes. So Sean said, yeah, definitely, come down to our practice. So I went down. I started with the intention of joining as a drummer, and as soon as I was down there, I was just like floored by the pipes, and I guess I made kind of a pest out of myself. I was constantly asking questions to the guys I played, and I asked the pipe major when he would be starting a new class, and he said, well, probably not for a while, stick with the drum. But there was another young fella in the band at that time, by the name of Colin Marr. And Colin was my age, and Colin was a very gifted player, and he had been playing for a while. And Colin said, I see you really have this bug for the pipes. He goes, I do. So Colin made me an offer at that time. He said that if I took it up seriously and I didn't waste the time, that he would teach me the pipes and he wouldn't charge me anything for it. So that was the beginning of how I ended up taking lessons from Colin. I got a set of pipes, and I just, I stuck with it, from then on. Colin Marr's dad was Pierce Marr, and in 1960, he had founded the NYPD pipe band and was one of their original instructors. And the NYPD pipe band actually was kind of the, many bands in the New York area came after they actually were the band that started Irish pipe bands in the New York City area.
Yeah, that was the one you always heard of. When you were young, you also got into the habit of riding on the FDNY fire trucks. How did that happen, and why was it allowed in those days?
Well, the way it started was, you know, my mom used to take me, drag me across Fordham Road, and there was an A&P on Webster Avenue. And at that time, Engine Company 48 was on Webster Avenue, just south. Their old firehouse was just south of Sears. And I would pass that firehouse, and I was very interested in the fire department. And when I was in the third grade, I met another kid that I went to grammar school with. Unfortunately, he has passed. Is my friend, my very good friend, Dennis O'Connell. And Dennis also had this interest, and we started going around and hanging around 48 Engines quarters when we were with third grade kids. And there was a fireman in the house, Jerry Cronin, that took a liking to us. And he said, listen, if you fellas come back here on this such and such a date, I'm going to have something for you. So back to the firehouse, we went, little third graders, and he had badges made up that said, Fire Buff, Engine Company 48. He gave us each a badge, and I guess it was hard to get rid of us after that. And as we turned into teenagers, the FDNY had started a program called the through the Boy Scouts of America, the FDNY Explorer Program, and they started an Explorer post in the quarters of Engine Company 88 and Ladder 38 on Belmont Avenue. And so we were Explorer Scouts there. And then in those days, things were a little bit different. I'd say when we were about 14 or 15, there were some fire companies that let the kids ride on the truck. There was I don't think it exists anymore today, an auxiliary fire corps. You had to be 18 years old. You could become an auxiliary fireman in New York City at the time. And they had training, and it went back to the days of World War II when they had supplemented, the auxiliary fire corps was there to supplement in case of a bombing, that they'd have civilians that would be able to help assist in fighting fires. So there was a lieutenant that was in charge of an FDNY lieutenant, auxiliary fire corps, and he had wind that there were a lot of these kids that were maybe 16, or, you know, we were underage, and some of the companies were letting us ride. So he kind of came around and put the offer out that if we applied for the auxiliary fire corps and didn't tell anyone that we were lying about our age, that we were 18, that he would accept us, and that's what we did. So actually, once we had that, and we went through this auxiliary fire training, we were it was legal that we would be able to ride on the trucks.
Riding on the trucks, one day, do a present when a friend from my old neighborhood, the late Jim McGuire, had a life-threatening accident. Tell us about that.
Well, I would say I was probably around somewhere around 18. And there was a vacant building fire on Claremont Parkway between Webster and 3rd Avenue. And I remember that the building was on the north side of Claremont Parkway. And all of a sudden there was commotion that fireman was badly injured. And what happened was that Jim McGuire was a fireman in Ladder 38, but I think he might have been detailed to Ladder 27 that night. He had the job of venting the roof. And the fire was on the top floor of a five-story tenement, and Jim went up the adjoining building. And when he stepped into the roof bulkhead, he opened the bulkhead door, the floor had been removed the landing, and it was covered with cardboard, so he couldn't see that there was no floor there. And the stairwell, I guess the building was under construction, the stairwell had also been removed, and he fell through the hole and came down five stories. And on the ground right where the area where he landed there were French doors, and they were like on a 45-degree angle, and the French doors, as you know, in the old buildings, have panes of glass. And he went through those glass panes. And I never forget them carrying him out in a Wyatt Stokes basket. And his face was shredded, and he had on a canvas. At that time, they had guys in a lot of companies, a lot of them wore these canvas turnout coats, and the coat was shredded, and he had a death grip on his tools. He had an axe and a Halligan tool and a death grip. As they were putting him on the ambulance, they were trying to take him out of his hands, and he wouldn't let go of them. And that was it. That ended his career at a fire department.
But he had recovered. He had a broken back, but he had recovered. And
yes.
And didn't you meet him, or you almost met him once?
Well, I'll tell you what actually happened was I was at one of the Narrowbacks meetings, and I heard a few guys at a table having a conversation about Jim McGuire, the fireman, and I hadn't seen him since he fell. And I went over to one of them and said, by any chance, you know, what's the guy you're talking about? Was he a fireman on Belmont Avenue in the Bronx? And they said, yeah, he was. And I said, well, you're not going to believe this, but I was there when I was a kid. You know, I was there when that accident happened to him. So I believe it might have been Jack Minogue. And he spoke to him and told him, yeah, there was a kid there. And I was supposed to meet him at one of he was looking forward to meeting me at one of the upcoming meetings. And unfortunately, after that, I learned that he had come down with terminal cancer, and before I got a chance to see him, Jim had passed away.
Yeah, very nice fella. After high school, you bethought it in joining the armed forces. What happened there?
Well, I was all pretty much my mind was made up on joining the Marine Corps, and I worked in the recruiting office quite a bit after school on Fordham and the Concourse. And I had lost my dad, my grandmother, and my uncle in a short period of time. And the war was going pretty heavy at that time. And my mother was starting to have a nervous breakdown over me. Enlisted. I was 17. I bought the recruiter's home. At 17, you could join with the parental consent. And my mom wouldn't sign the papers. And come 18, there was, it was up to me. And I tried to join when I was 18. And somehow somebody, I guess I'd spoken to a congressman, and I had a hardship, and I couldn't join. There was a hardship in my family, and that precluded that.
That was the end of that.
Yeah.
Had you always wanted to be a cop? I can call them cops.
Well,
like,
what would you
I'm from a long line.
I was 100% wanted to be a fireman, and I have to say that I was very lucky because myself and the kids that I grew up with, we had the best role models of probably of any kid could ever dream of. And in those days, the fire department was very busy in the 60s and 70s. Those they called them the warriors. It's the days when the Bronx, was literally burning. But I ended up getting a change of heart. My brother-in-law was in the police department. I had an uncle, my sister's husband, and for some reason I thought that let me try being a cop first. I'll give that a try. And then eventually my plan was always to go in the fire department, but. That was around the time when I was applying for these jobs that the city was broke, and cops and firemen ended up getting laid off. So in my neighborhood, I think the pinnacle of its success was to become a fireman or a cop or a sanitation worker. And the older guys, the generation, were all on the NYPD and the FDNY were sanitation men. And the guys from my age group, a lot of us had to go elsewhere to get jobs because the city had the job freeze, and I eventually ended up getting hired in Yonkers and on Yonkers PD, and I ended up liking the job and stayed there.
Now, was there a residence requirement for Yonkers? Did you have to move?
There was a residence requirement, and I had moved to Yonkers in 1977. I was a resident, and I got hired in January of 1979.
When you joined the force, you got right into their bagpipes. I believe, even though some had difficulty thinking that the Italian could play Irish pipes. Was that true?
Yeah, well, the way that happened was, I would say maybe a month before I was sworn in, I was in a bar in Yonkers. That was an Irish bar, and it was a popular hangout for guys that were in the Westchester Police Pipe Band. And two of them came in uniform, and I got in a conversation with them. And one guy I became very good friends with, his name, he had also passed, Ronnie O'Rourke, who's a great guy. And the other fellow was a drummer. And for some reason, I was in a conversation about, I told him I played pipes, and the drummer didn't believe me. And he was telling me, you're full of bull, you don't play the pipes. And so I was getting a little bit ticked. And I asked the piper, Ronnie, if I could play his pipes, which I did. And I guess I put that to rest. And so the word got out that when a kid that was getting hired in the new class, I doubt I even told him my name, but a piper was getting hired in the January class. So the day that I was getting sworn in, I was standing there maybe 10 minutes before taking the oath, and a captain walked in, and his name was Owen McLean, and he's looking around at the recruits that are standing there, and he comes and he's standing right in front of me, and he says to the guy to my right who had reddish hair, he's like, you're the guy that plays the pipes? And that fellow said, no, not me. And he's looking around, he's looking over me, around me, he's like, you're the guy that plays the pipes? And he's four or five guys is getting frustrated. He goes, who's the guy that plays the pipes here? And I'm standing directly in front of him. I said, I raised my hand, it's me. Are you joining the band? I says, I guess I am. All right, be at band practice on, I believe it was on Monday nights then. So I got sworn in on a Friday, and I think it was Thursday, and then came that Monday. It was my first band practice. So I ended up going down there and joining the band.
You said even when you got there, there was some consternation that you could play because of your name. Was that true?
Yeah, that's true. And then they said, well, you have to have an audition. And I grabbed a set of pipes. I played, and the next thing was, okay, they hand me an application to join the Emerald Society. And I get to the line where it says, where are you? Was your family from in Ireland? I said, well, what am I supposed to put here? They said, well, isn't your mother Irish? I said, no. So they said, oh, my God, there was a big uproar. What are we going to do now? And anyway, they said, come back next week. We'll let you know if you can join the band. And the following week came back, and they said, well, you're in the band, but you can't vote because you're not a member of the Emerald Society. So, all right, whatever. And that was, that's what happened with that. But when I first started playing, I think it was people thought it was very odd, but it's not so much anymore. If you see the pipe bands are made up, there's quite a lot of diversity as far as nationalities in the bands that people like to play, and I don't really get that. People would be waiting for me after I play. Oh, you're the Italian guy, and I would go through this whole story. Over and over again, why I was playing pipes and how I got interested in it. But I have to say, I'm really glad I did. I love everything about this instrument. I love playing, and it's been good to me.
Now, over the years, you've gotten into what you call to me competition bands. What are they, and where do they compete, and how does that work?
Well, there's in this region is the Eastern United States Pipe Band Association, which is a sanctioning body for competitive bagpipe bands and also for solo competition for solo competitors. And basically structured to try to get bands to come in at an entry level and to develop them so that they move on and continue to improve and move up. The entry level for pipe bands in the United States is grade 5 level. Grade 1 being the highest. I think present, we only have two grade one bands in the United States. So it's very hard to get to grade one. So I'm in a band now. I'm competing with, it's only been around for a year. It's Empire Pipe Band. It's made up of mostly people, kids that played and graduated from Iona College that are very serious players. And we were skipped. We didn't have to start in grade five. We started in grade four last year, which we did very well. We got a lot of above grade where they ranked as a playing above our grade level. So hopefully by next year, if we have another good year, we'll be upgraded to the next grade, grade three, and take it on from there. But I'm really happy to be in this band. Kids are very serious about it. They're driven, and I'm the oldest guy in the band. I have to work pretty hard to, as you know, when we get older, we start to lose certain things like dexterity, and my memory is not that great as far as learning tunes. I mean, we just got handed, I think, 23 new tunes that we have to have down for this year. So it's ambitious, but I really like it.
Now, on television, we only see bagpipers generally marching in parades. Is the competition also a marching competition, or is it sitting around on a bandstand playing? How is it?
Well, the way it's structured for pipe bands is that the bands have to come into like a band formation, like you would see as they were marching on the street, and they march in as into a there's a circle that is chalked out on the competition field, and they have to march from that formation into a circle. And they will play whatever the requirement of their grade is, the tunes. In my grade, we have to have what's called a medley, which are all different types of time signatures and tunes. And then we also have to be able to play what's called a march, strats, bay, and reel, which are much kind of heavier, more difficult tunes. And there are judges that will be there that are sanctioned by the Pipe Band Association, and there'll be two piping judges, a drumming judge, and what they call an ensemble judge. The ensemble judge judges the unity of the pipes matching the drumming. So all those scores are tabulated, and then the bands are ranked as where they come in as far as points.
Okay. Back to the police force, there was one case probably early in your career. You were riding in the radio car that we've discussed a number of times, and it may be the subject of a recent book you told me. Could you please tell the audience about that case?
Yep. The case that you're talking about was the unfortunate shooting of Westchester County police officer Gary Stimolowski. From my perspective, I guess the way I'll start the story was that I was on patrol in a radio car in the 4th Precinct with my partner Robert Maitre Jr. That night, it was February 24th, 1985. It was in the evening, and it was a bit of a brisk night. It wasn't as cold as it could be for that time of year. And we were wearing, at that time, we wore black leather patrol jackets. I distinctly remember that. And we were sitting at an intersection, and we see a county police car with lights on racing toward us. And he sees our car, and he slams on the brakes. And there was the officer in that car was a guy that we later knew as George Farrell. And George said, hey, did you see one of my cars come by here? So we said, no. They said, well, one of our cars was in pursuit. He had a car stop on the Solomon Parkway, and we're trying to get to reach him on the radio, and he's not answering. So we said, no, we definitely didn't see him. And I reached for the radio to put it across a broadcast. And at that time, my radio, our dispatcher was coming across the information that George had just told me. It started coming out of our radio. So my squad sergeant, Larry McElrone, called all the cars in the 4th Precinct to meet him at a location where we were going to organize a grid search to go out and search for this the cop that wasn't answering the radio. And at that time, we were going heading to meet him, and a radio broadcast came over that the that there was a police car with the lights on and the engine running at the intersection of Van Buren and Prescott Streets. We were about maybe two blocks from there, so we raced in and we see the car sitting there with the door was open. The engine was running, the headlights were on, and we thought maybe the officer was in foot pursuit. So there was a hill that went up to a ball field, so we got on the air, so we were going to search the ball field at the top of this hill. So we're going up the hill, my sergeant pulled in right behind us and went up to the car, and then he started screaming that he had a cop shot in the car. We went up to the top of the hill. We searched the hill, and at the edge of the field on the top, there was a pile of illegally dumped construction debris. At that time, we didn't have good flashlights. We had these Con Edison D-cell battery lights, and we were looking through the pile, moving the pile around, and we ended up running. They needed an escort. They were taking the officer to St. Joseph's Medical Center. So we left that location. Later, we came to find out that this police officer, Gary Stimulowski, was on traffic enforcement on the Sulman Parkway, and right by there's a Jewish home for the blind. He had pulled over a car for speeding. There were four occupants in the car, and it was driven by a Alex Mengel, who was a 30-year-old Guyanese immigrant. When Gary got his paperwork and he wrote a summons, he was writing summonses, ran the plate, came out that had expired registration. So he continued writing summonses and he went back to the vehicle and he told the driver. He had said that his car was getting impounded for the expired registration. And was there anything in the vehicle that he needed to know about? So the driver, Alex Mengel, told Gary Stimulowski that there were, he had come from hunting, and he had shotguns in the trunk. So Gary went back to his car, got on the radio. He asked for a car to stand by while he impounded his car because the guy, told him there were shotguns. Alex Mengel, the driver of the vehicle, tells the other passengers that, listen, when you hear a shot fired, take off with the car. He gets out of his vehicle, starts approaching the police car. Witnesses had heard Stimulowski tell him, go back to your car. And then he told him again, I'm not going to tell you again, go back to your car. Mengel had a 9mm pistol stuck in his waistband. He came up. He shot Gary Stimulowski point blank in the face. He opened the car door to Gary Stimulowski's police car, and he removed Gary Stimulowski's service revolver and pushed his body into the center of the car, got in, closed the door, and took off with the police car with Gary's body in the front seat. At that point, Gary Stimulowski's backup was coming northbound on the Sawmill Parkway and sees the car get off at a high rate of speed at Yonkers Avenue, and that's why they thought that Gary was in pursuit of this vehicle that he had stopped. The other occupants of the vehicle took off. The plate number came back to the Bronx, an address in the Bronx. The car was registered to Mengel's ex-wife. Detectives went down there to the Bronx. They ended up grabbing the other occupants that were there, and that's they made an ID on this Alex Mengel as a shooter. Mengel was a, I guess, some kind of a experienced woodsman. And during the night, he made his way up, and he was hiding in the woods. And the next day, he abducted a woman that was an IBM employee. She's 44 years old, and her name was Beverly Capone. An innocent woman went to get in her vehicle. He abducted the woman, took her vehicle, and he proceeded up to, I believe it was Cairo, New York, and he killed this the woman, Beverly Capone. And the psycho that he was, he dismembered her. He took her hair and her face, and he made himself up to look like a woman to get into Canada. He contacted someone in a cousin of his to get money from in up in Buffalo that was going to I think the University of Buffalo at the time, and he also tried to abduct a I think a 16-year-old female upstate somewhere, and she ran away. Luckily, she ran away from him. He makes his way into Canada. During the investigation, when they spoke this, the kid, his cousin in Buffalo, I guess, got scared, and he notified the Buffalo police that this cousin of his said he had shot a cop in Westchester, and he was escaping into Canada. They started to run the vehicle type that she was driving. It was a white, it might have been a Toyota, I'm not sure. Anyway, then they find that this woman was a missing person from Mount Vernon. So they gave out the plate number, and they broadcast it in Canada. And a police officer in Toronto spots the vehicle. And after a brief pursuit, Mangle crashed into a snowbank in a shopping mall. And he was taken into custody. And the poor woman's scalp was recovered, and her hair, in Mangle's vehicle. So Mangle now is getting extradited back for the shooting of police officer Stimulowski. And detectives from Yonkers and the county police go up there to extradite him. The next day, the day after they get back, I get called to the detective division, and there was a detective, Vinny Panalano, had the paperwork in front of him of what I had done the night before at the crime scene. And one of the things that I had put down was that we had searched that debris pile. So he says, this is your report? I said, yes, yeah, yes it is. He said, well, he goes, Alex Mangle said there were almost three dead cops the night of the shooting. And he went on to tell me that Mangle had told him that he was hiding in that debris pile, that we couldn't see some of the lights, and he was about to shoot myself and my partner, Bob Maitrey. He had the officer Stimulowski's service revolver aimed at one of us, and he had his 9mm at the other. So the bizarre events continue. The state police had taken Mangle up to and arraign him for the murder up in upstate of Beverly Capone. And I guess they were transporting him. He was in the back of the state police car, and I think they're on the Taconic Parkway when the trooper that was driving the vehicle hears a commotion in the back seat. And when he turns around, Mangle had both his hands on the trooper that was riding in the back with him on his gun, and he was biting his throat. The trooper in the front seat pulled onto the shoulder and shot Mangle, and that was the end of the story with him. There was an upcry that people would start to suspect that he was shot by the troopers because he killed a cop, and which turned out the shooting was 100% justified. I myself and Maitrey had been to the medical examiner's office on something that was on an unrelated homicide that we had. And there was a medical examiner at the time, was Dr. Louis Rowe. And he said, "Hey, come here, I got to show you guys something." So we went into his laboratory, and he had made a mold of Mengele's teeth from his corpse, and he matched the teeth marks bite marks into the trooper's neck. And he said that he was very close to killing that trooper with a bite. That it was like a fraction of an inch away from crushing his windpipe.
Wow!
So it's a crazy story, but these things happen.
That's some story. You also described recently to some of the Barnes & Noble All Stars how you work in the Yonkers PD's emergency service unit, took you into conferences with anti-terrorist units of the foreign countries, both the French and the Israelis. Tell us something about that work.
Yes, I had joined a organization that was called the National Tactical Officers Association, which at that time, it's out of Pennsylvania now, but at that time it was out of Los Angeles. And it was started by members of the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department, their former commander, a really great guy by the name of John Coleman. And the purpose of that was to train SWAT teams and give them the apparatus to train up to a very high level. And the NTOA had advertised a training trip that was going to England, France, Germany, and Israel to observe their counterterrorist teams in action. And that was in April of 1988. So I said, wow, I really would like to go to this thing, you know, and I signed up for it. And it was a very reasonable price. And the next thing you know, I found myself the first stop that we made in that trip was in Israel, and we went up to a base that was called in a place called Lod, and it was the headquarters of their national hostage rescue team, which was called the Yamam, and I don't know what it means in Hebrew, but it was their very high-speed hostage rescue team that was operated by the Federal Border Police. And we spent some time there, and from there we went to France. We were in Versailles with they're called GIGN Group, Gendarme International Group Intervention is, pardon my French, but I cannot pronounce it properly, but we had spent some time there. From there, we got on a train. We were up in Germany, and the Germans had a unit up there called GSG-9, and we finished off the trip with the Metropolitan Police of London that had... At the time, they called their unit PT-17, but I think that the designation of that team has changed numerous times since then. But it was a great experience.
You told me you were very impressed with the Israeli leader, and then he pointed out to you a significant difference between the high-tech Americans and the low-tech Israelis. Could you?
He did. Yeah, he did. When our first day there, we were waiting in a classroom for their commander, and his name was Colonel Alec Aron. I believe that he became a general, actually, in the IDF after a while. And he walked into the room, and there was something about him, a presence that you could feel. And Alec Aron and we got something. He seemed very serious. You know, no fooling around, you know, kind of individual. And we got to know him pretty well, and he came to some of our conferences. He came over, in fact, he was at a conference with us in San Diego. But one of the things when I was over there that I discussed with him was that I said, We were talking about equipment. He said, well, he goes, a big difference between us and the Americans, he goes, you guys are like really like gadgets and, you know, fancy things. We don't, he goes, we have very, we're low drag, but low, you know, we have stuff that works and that's it, you know. And he like things like they have we used to have these bus assault ladders for a hostage rescue on a bus. And he said, no, we don't use them. They would just have a soldier kind of get on all fours, and they would jump up on it. One guy would jump up on the soldier's back. So he said, yeah, we don't need a ladder for that, you know. So they were very, very good at what they did, and they didn't depend on too much on gadgets and things like that. But yeah, it was a great experience, though.
Jim Finn, who's standing by, is retired NYPD lieutenant and has been to one or two of the Arabax luncheons. Jim, welcome. Do you have questions? Done anything that Rince has told us about police work so far? Jim? Does he realize that I'm talking to him? On the 84, I'm sorry, that's not the 845 number that I thought it was. Who was on the 848 number? Who's coming in from the 848 exchange? 469? Okay. Well, then we'll go on with it. Do you have any other cases come to mind that you think the audience might be interested in?
I was discussing a job that happened in Tarrytown. We had a Tarrytown PD had a call of a retired, I think it was a Mamaroneck police officer that was despondent. He was he lived up behind the I think it was Rushneck Pontiac at that time, and he was living with his wife and his daughter and the daughter's boyfriend. And something set him off, and he ended up shooting the wife and the daughter, and he shot the boyfriend in the neck. But the boyfriend didn't go down. He was able to get up and run to the Pontiac dealer and call for help. And the shooter was in front of his house letting shots go, and there were people pinned down, several people behind a tree. And so there was a hotline that came across that they needed an armored vehicle. So we responded up there with our armored vehicle. And when we got there, there was a husband and his pregnant wife were pinned down behind a tree. We removed them. Westchester County Police responded, and they removed, there were some cops from another jurisdiction. They got those people removed to safety. And it went on for quite a while, and we were going to make entry at one point, several hours into the situation. And when we were about to go in, make entry, the suspect came to the front door, came out, and there was a containment team of officers from the Greenberg SWAT team. And it was the senior cop at the time on that team was a guy named Mike Anacarico, and Mike was able to get behind him and tackle him. And then when we did finally made entry into the apartment, the wife and the daughter were deceased.
There have been, even the recent case that we talked about like that, does this happen more than we like to think? Is there any depression or despondency that seems to run through retired police officers who they don't have the same, either it's respect from the community or they don't have the same authority they had before? And is this a normal thing? And do police departments worry about that? And do they have programs for people who retire?
I would say, based on the high suicide rate of police officers, that it is somewhat of a problem. I mean, it doesn't often come to this, but it is something that I think back in years past, it was swept, you know, things like that were swept under the rug, and now they realize that people, when you know, you're dealing with the negative part of human life every time, every day in your job, sometimes it has a an effect on the person. And they do have the people realize that people do sometimes have post-traumatic stress disorder and things like that. And it's not not shameful to get to seek treatment for those things, where at one time I think any person that would even consider it would be worried about being drummed, losing their job. And so I think it's people are kind of enlightened and understand that. And I would say with the way things are at the moment, I'm talking to a lot of people that are still cops. They're very down, and I can understand why. And I really have great concerns on and what direction things are going to go in the future, because it's not a perfect job. You make a life and death decision in a split second. Sometimes it's not the right decision. You know, you're getting judged by people in Hollywood that they can do the same scene over 100 times. Doesn't matter, but there's no do-over. And sometimes we're right, sometimes we're wrong, and sometimes we're portrayed to be wrong. And I think what's happening is that more and more police officers and law enforcement people are reluctant to take action. And that's when things, you see crime rates and things start to climb. So,
yeah, there's a fellow from my old neighborhood in Bronx Emergency Services, very well liked by everyone in the neighborhood, and he was known for reaching out to people, and something snapped, and he took his life. And the fellow that lives very close to me now was very close friends with him, and he immediately transferred out of emergency services. He said he should have seen the deterioration on this fellow and the despondency that had taken over after the few incidents there.
I've seen that happen. You know, in my unit, there was a guy that I worked with 2 days. One day we had a person that was in a trench collapse, and I didn't work that day. I came in the next day, but he was on that job, and he was talking to this poor guy that was in a trench collapse, and the guy actually expired while he was talking to him. And the next day we had a jumper on Central Avenue in one of the high buildings. It was a 19-year-old kid that was despondent over a breakup with his girlfriend. And this kid, mid-sentence, he jumped. And we were rigged up to make a grab on him, but we weren't close enough at that point. And that day this other officer said he had enough, and he ended up going to the detective division, but he 2 days in a row was a bit much for him, you know. So yeah, I could see it when you deal with stuff like that day in and day out, it could really have an effect on you.
I mentioned Jim Finn earlier. He and I, as you know, have attended a number of the Narrowback meetings. You're one of the regular organizers of the monthly luncheons. How did you get involved with the Narrowbacks, and tell us something about the group?
Well, I'm a really, really close friends with, you guys call him Jack Sharkey, I call him Pat Sharkey, but he's a kid from my neighborhood that I grew up with on 193rd Street, Decatur. I've been friends since kindergarten with him. And he was a really good friend of Danny Lynch. Danny is the president. He's one of the best guys you'll ever meet. He's about 82 years old. He's from Inwood. And Danny had put a group of guys together that would go have lunch in Eileen's kitchen that were all first-generation Irish-Americans. And he said, hey, we should call ourselves the Narrowbacks. And the luncheon got so big that they decided to move it next door. And Eileen, the owner of Eileen's Kitchen and the Heritage, is very, very gracious to us, and she allowed us to start the meetings in the downstairs room of the bar that she also has, the Heritage. And I was asked to come down and play the pipes and then once in a while sing a song. And it's a very talented group of people. We have, as you know, yourself being a poet, and we have maybe 8 or 9 guys that could get up and give a song. We have guys that play different instruments, accordions, myself. We start off the meeting with the pipes. And then we decided to dedicate the group's name after PFC Thomas F. Minogue, who was a soldier in Vietnam. He was one of our members, Jack Minogue's brother, who was killed, who saved the better part of his platoon and his company commander. He was a medic, and he was recommended for the Medal of Honor. He was approved all the way up the line for the Medal of Honor, but he ended up getting the second highest medal, which is the Distinguished Service Cross. And one of the missions of the Narrowbacks now is to get that medal upgraded to the Medal of Honor. Thomas was killed in March of 1965, and was responsible for a lot of other soldiers coming home that day. So
now Jim Malarkey, who's a member of the group, he's the next airborne guy. Then he seems to be doing the bunch of the heavy lifting on the. With Congress trying to get him the medal.
Yes.
Was Jim in the group from the beginning?
No, Jim came, I think Jim has maybe been in the group for about 2 years, but he has done a tremendous amount of work and bringing this case to Congress that this medal should have been a Medal of Honor from the beginning. And he is really... gone to Washington. He's knocking on people's doors, and he was a Green Beret in Vietnam himself. I think he's got one of the highest amount of parachute jumps on record.
Yeah, he parachuted into the Shea Yankee Stadium as part of a July 4th thing years and years ago. He also mentioned at one of the meetings that the reason that he was told was that it didn't go to the highest level was there had been two fellas from the same either brigade or battalion who had been approved from it in the previous month or two, and they didn't want that many concentrated in one unit. Do you remember that story?
That is correct, and that is pretty much the same way that I had heard it, is that that I'm trying to think was General Wheeler was
okay,
the head
Wheeler.
Of the joint. Yeah, he was head of the Joint Chiefs of Staffs, and he made a comment that it wouldn't look good, to give out that many Medal of Honors, But I think that's pretty unfair when the action that was taken deserved it. The highest honor that the country can give to a soldier.
Frank Hickey, who had planned to call in last week, as a matter of fact, had been. When the system went down, wasn't available tonight, but he had been a member of the various police forces, the Savannah Police Force and the LAPD, and when he was at NY, the LAPD, Bill Bratton was his police commissioner, and Bill got them into something that Frank really likes. Frank's the novelist, and he's written a number of books on community policing. What does that mean to you? I'm not really clear on the definition. Do you understand it?
On community policing itself?
Yeah.
I think the theory of having the community know that cop, as back in the days when you had the foot cop and the people in the neighborhood knew him, I think in theory, it works great. I'm just not sure that the practicality of where you need the amount of manpower that you can actually do that. So by having certain units and that go out and strike up a rapport with the public, if you have a rapport and you establish some kind of a trust, I think it works both ways. that if the public gets faith and they get to know, you know, the police soldier. But it's a two-way street. I think most of the focus is put on the police, but a lot of the areas where the police go in, they're not welcome, and they're in a very unfriendly environment. And you can I'll give you an example. I was on patrol one day in an emergency truck, and I got flagged down that a person was choking. I got out of the truck. There's a 30-year-old male unconscious on the ground, turning blue, and the guys in emergency service are trained as EMTs, so I get the medical kit out, and I have a what's called a bag valve mask to start to push air into his lungs and resuscitate him. And as I squeeze the bag to the bag valve mask, the air comes out the side of his mouth, which told me right away that his airway was totally obstructed. So I opened his mouth, put my finger in, and lo and behold, his entire throat was blocked with pizza cheese. And I start pulling the pizza cheese out, and all of a sudden, whap! And he takes a big gasp of breath, and he starts breathing on his own. So I give him some oxygen, and after a couple of whiles, I'm kind of kneeling over him. I'm giving him some additional oxygen. He opens his eyes, and he looks up and punches me square in the face. And the fight was on. And I ended up fighting this guy all the way to Central Booking. And the people on the street were screaming at him, like, this guy just saved you. And in fact, when he started breathing, the people were clapping. But they just... You know, some people that no matter what we do, and you're not gonna win with the way people perceive. I guess perception means everything, and if you're perceived to not be a friendly person, that's the way it's gonna be.
But we know many of the cops in the 34th by name. It was Tony the cop, and it was a guy called Wyatt Earp, because he looked like he always wanted to draw his gun, and all these good guys. But one funny story. There was a friend of mine named Clayton Hollinger, very good-looking guy. He was smart. He had been away to be the brother. He came home very glib. All the girls were crazy about him, but he never should have smelled alcohol. And his father was the partner of Bill Shea, as in Shea Stadium. He's a law partner. So he calls them, the kids together, they were – Bill Fordham, and he says that he's going to be nominated for the federal judgeship. Do nothing to embarrass me. The FBI is going to be running background checks, and do nothing to embarrass me. Yeah, we got it, Dad. That night, Clay took a girl out in Bergen County, New Jersey. It was a cold night. I think it was either October or November. And he took her home, and he came downstairs, and there wasn't the cab in sight. Or a bus, but there was a New Jersey State Police car with no one in it and the motor running. So Clay said, well, that looks good to me. So he jumps in a car, goes across the George Washington Bridge, one stops, pulls up in front of the Capitol in Inwood, with the restaurant, and gets out, and Tony the cop's standing there. And Tony said, I didn't know you were a New Jersey State cop. Then Clay said, I'm not. So Tony said, come here. And that was a Friday night. The next day, it's the slow news day. So his picture is on the front page of the Daily News with Tony holding from behind. It's in all the papers. And the judge did go through. And when Clay got married less than a year later, the only non-family family member at the wedding was Tony the cop.
Oh, really? Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's a great story.
Now, you had mentioned to us, back to the bagpipes, that you had mentioned to us that I knew there was a difference between Scotch and Irish bagpipes, but you also said there's Israeli pipes and there's pipes from all over. What are the differences, basically, between these different kinds of pipes?
Well, back in the ancient times, almost every civilization had some form of a bagpipe. And I guess it was somewhere around the period of the Renaissance when with the dawning of modern instruments, that in a lot of those places the pipes became not so popular, obviously they had to consider it somewhat primitive. But the Scots and the Irish traditions, a lot were, you know, were pretty solidly based around the pipes. The Scottish pipes, which are called the Highland bagpipes, the most recognizable pipes that you would see, they're also very popular with the Irish. But the real Irish pipes are called it's the Gaelic word for elbow, Uilleann pipes. And they're not blown. You sit in a chair, and instead of blowing into them, there's bellows under your arm that blow the bag up. And they're probably the most beautiful sounding pipes that you'd ever want to hear. And they say that the sound from the Irish pipes are the closest to the human voice. The Israeli.
Now, which do you play?
Those pipes that I play are the Highland pipes.
Oh, they are.
Most of the Uremel Society bands, we actually play the Highland bagpipe.
So the Gaelic societies play the Scottish bagpipes.
I think it was kind of an across-the-board instrument that you had in Ireland and Scotland as well. You know, you had it in both countries. At one time, the Irish called they had the same pipes that they only had. Instead of three drones, they had two. And they were referred to as the Irish war pipe.
Oh, okay.
But what I was saying about the Israelis is that the Highland pipes have taken off worldwide, and Israel is a pipe band of Highland pipes. They have a pipe band association there, as well as they do. I mean, a lot of countries, Germany, Italy, Spain, France. Canada's huge, the bagpipes, Australia, New Zealand. So it's pretty much a worldwide instrument now. And every year at the World Championships in Glasgow, Scotland, there are bands that are coming over from everywhere. And the Republic of Ireland right now has two very, very good pipe bands. In Dublin, you have St. Lawrence O'Toole pipe band, which is under pipe major Terry Tully. And then up in the north, you have a band that's Field Marshal Montgomery pipe band that I think they've won 5 world championships. But and there's maybe 6 other grade 1 pipe bands up in the north of Ireland. But they're kind of... I said when my grandfather was a kid in Italy, they have a form of pipes that they look quite different than these pipes. And he said at Christmas time, the pipers would come around into the village and play. And you see them on a lot of old pieces of art. They're kind of strange looking pipes. The pipes are smaller and the bag is gigantic. And I think it's called the Zambogna.
Okay.
But they had a different. Each culture kind of had their own kind of set of pipes. The Greeks even had pipes.
Really?
So, yeah. Yep.
You've got the bagpipes, the competition. You've got the narrow bags. You've got reading in Barnes and Noble. What's next for you?
Right now, I'm concentrating on playing pipes. That's my passion now. I'm retired, and being able to keep up with these young kids in this band, that's kind of, I have my hands full with that. So that's where most of my efforts lie at this stage of the game. And I think I have to put twice as much work into it because of the fact of my age. I'm losing some of my dexterity. Things are not as easy for me to do as they were at one time. So I would hate to see the day when I couldn't play pipes anymore.
I keep
at it pretty strong, and it's when you're doing something you love to do, it's a great thing.
I know my orthopedist just took me off basketball. He said no, you can't do that anymore. We've touched the bases. What else would you like the audience to know about you?
Well, I'm fortunate to have two great sons. My my oldest son played football at Tufts University, and he's now he's in Chicago. He's he's working as a, in the finance market. And my youngest son is he's this the 12th of December. He graduates from his basic infantry officer school at Fort Benning, and in February he starts Ranger School. And after Ranger School, he's going to be assigned to the 101st Airborne in Fort Campbell. So they were both. I was fortunate to have them both home for the holidays, and we had a really, really good time. And I guess as far as other things going on in my life, that's probably the main my main thing.
My infantry sergeant in the Army, when someone asked him whether he had been airborne, said, "My mommy didn't raise an idiot to jump out of airplane."
That's great. Yeah. That's a good line. That's a good line. Well, I say, when people say, "How do you feel about your son jumping out of airplanes?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I'm very happy. At least he has a parachute attached to him." When he was a kid, he was a daredevil. He was on a skateboard, and I looked up on a roof, and he'd be on the edge of a roof trying to ride around him. So he had no fear. So at least now he'll be tied to a parachute.
A parachute.
So we're both safer about that.
Well, thank you very much, Rince. It's been a real pleasure, and thanks for coming back after the problem last week.
Oh, you're welcome. It's always great to talk to you, John, and I'm sure I'll see you soon up in Barnes & Noble or at the Narrowbacks meeting.
Right. All right. Well, a bit of commercial information. My column appears regularly in the Westchester Guardian, which has been a weekly, but it is going to a biweekly beginning in December, and along with regular columns by Congressperson, Co-Chair of the 9/11 Commission, Lee Hamilton, and Critic John Simon. The Westchester Guardian is available in print format and then online at www.westchesterguardian.com. My books are available at Amazon, and I have a blog at johnmac13.johnmacrants.com. And John Mac Rants is JohnMacRants. And in the words of the Mets radio announcer, Howie Rose, after the Mets win, and we almost took it all this year, put it in a book. And steady, Silver, steady. We'll be right back.